Welcome to episode 70 of the Camerosity Podcast, the world's number one open source film photography podcast. My name is Mike Ekman, and we are back in time to the 1970s, the decade of disco and big hair. In this episode, the guys will cover all the innovations and trends in the photographic world that shaped the decade, from the best to the worst, to the near misses, to the strange and unusual. Before we get to that, it's time for some introductions. Starting us off, from the TSA check-in on his way to Ireland is Mr. Paul Reibold. Hey, Paul, how long is it going to take them to hand check all of your camera bags?
Global entry is a wonderful thing. You put the thing on the conveyor belt, they run it through, they wag their finger at you for having so much shit that you're carrying, and they don't even look.
Next, from Sydney, Australia, is Mr. Theo Panagopoulos, who is planning his own family vacation to Vietnam. How much time in advance will you need to decide which cameras to pack?
Pretty much from the moment we decided to book, because my wife actually already had a go at me saying, why are you fretting about the camera when we've just booked and it's months away? So.
And finally, from Gainesville, Florida, is Mr. Anthony Rue. Hey, Anthony, don't you have any concerts coming up that you're going to see?
Oh, I'll be flying up to Detroit to see PJ Harvey and working on a few others that I haven't bought tickets for, but am lining up flights.
Well, maybe if I could arrange it, I could meet you in the Motor City and we could walk around.
Actually, it looks like I'm going to be coming up to Bloomington and then up to Chicago before the summer's out.
Awesome. That's going to be great. All right. We have a number of people in the waiting room, some familiar names and a couple that I don't recognize. So let's let some people in. All right. I got some familiar faces. I see Tim Peters is back. Welcome back, Tim.
Hello.
Patrick Casey. Hey, Patrick. Welcome back.
Hello.
Jordan Beru, are you there? Jordan, you were on the last episode, right?
Yeah, I was.
Yeah, okay. You signed in and then Anthony had to leave. So you had talked about meeting him at the KEH function
yeah.
A while back. All right, cool. Welcome back again. Will Pinkham. Will, I don't think you've been on the show before, have you?
No, I haven't. This is my first time.
First time caller. Will, you want to introduce yourself?
Yeah, my name's Will Pinkham. I don't know. I've been photographing since I was like 14, which is kind of an eternity now. Not much professionally. I did Japanese weddings in Hawaii for a while, which was fun.
Oh, cool.
Now I'm in kind of the Binghamton, New York area, which an interesting photographic history.
Yeah. Home of Ansco.
Yeah. Yeah. In fact, I'm not far from the Ansco Lofts building, which is where their factory was, which was just kind of cool.
Very cool. All right. Well, welcome to the show. And then one more person. I'm really going to do my best on this one, but Gearwin Click? Is that even close to correct?
Yeah, close enough.
Well, welcome. You want to introduce yourself?
So I'm Gearwin. I'm from Belgium, 28 years old, and collecting, repairing, whatever. I want to show my setup, but it's 2 a.m. here. So
yeah.
Not the best conditions to show like the testers and stuff, but anyways, you probably know me from the Facebook group.
Yes.
I post quite a lot as well. Yeah.
Yep. Your name is very recognizable. I just never thought I'd have to say it out loud. So I'm glad to hear that I didn't do too bad of a job. Well, welcome to the show. And Daniel Belmez, is that right, Daniel?
Yeah, that's correct. Hello.
All right. Now, have you been on the show before?
I've been on for the Graflex episode, yes.
The Graflex. Okay, it's been a while. I thought your name looked familiar. Do you want to reintroduce yourself real quick?
Yeah, probably going to keep it short. I think it's 70s, so I got the F1 with me. Yeah, I'm a photographer. I've been shooting, well, not photographer. I'm more of a camera collector. I had to clarify that when I at an event the other day. The photographer there, we were still talking about film cameras, and I don't compare me. I collect like 50 cameras at this point. Mainly large format, really into like the Polaroid 110B conversions for 4x5 right now.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That should be enough for an intro.
Well, welcome. Welcome back, I should say. We're re-welcoming you. You brought up a point that I've had a conversation with people a number of times. I was talking to a guy through Facebook Messenger about, you know, being a photographer and collecting cameras. And while I think for many people, the photography aspect and the collecting of cameras is, you know, kind of hand in hand. There are clearly some people who just like to collect cameras, but that don't ever shoot them. Whereas I'm kind of somewhere in the middle. Like I shoot my cameras, but I feel like I love the cameras more than the photography itself. Like I don't consider myself a very good photographer. If you look at some of the images I post in my reviews, if you see a good picture, it's more than likely a happy accident. I'm more of a snapshot kind of guy, but I enjoy the process. And that's why I shoot still a lot of digital in addition to film. I kind of like to do a little bit of both, but I think the biggest motivation for me in collecting has been the history and, you know, the workmanship of the cameras, you know, the tactile touch, the way they feel, the sounds, everything about them.
Yeah.
Really, really like that. And then I like that they can be used too. I think that that's unique compared to many types of collecting. You know, I mean, if you're a stamp collector, you're not going to be mailing things with your stamps, of course. You know, a lot of people who collect guns, I know people like to shoot guns, but sometimes your antique guns, you're really not supposed to shoot anymore. But, you know, you get an old camera, you know, send off a 1930 Leica, get it repaired, and it's going to work just as good as the day it was when it was new. And I love that aspect of it, that, you know, with, even though we have less film than ever before, with like, you know, your T-grain films or such, you could actually get, in my opinion, sharper and better looking images out of a 1930s Leica with modern film than people in 1930 were getting out of those cameras when they were new. So yeah, I mean, you said that you like collecting too, and I would consider myself to be on that boat. I guess I'm a collector first and a photographer second.
I'm kind of the opposite.
No, a lot of people are. I mean, yeah. Honestly, I think I'm in the minority, because you have your people that are clearly just collectors. Ira Cohen is a collector. He doesn't shoot 99% of his stuff.
Yeah.
There's a lot of people like that just put the stuff on a shelf. Whereas I do use mine, but I still lean towards the collecting side more than the photography. Like I don't get excited over like an Ansel Adams exhibit or something. I have tremendous respect. I'm sure the Jeff and Gabe are going to make fun of me. Like Ekman's ripping on Ansel Adams now too. instead of Vivian Meyer, but no, you mentioned that in your intro, and it was just a conversation I had just had with somebody recently about collecting versus being a photographer. And I'm clearly one side of that.
See, I'm the opposite of you, Mike, because I wouldn't keep a camera if I couldn't shoot it.
Right.
You know, for me, it's about the whole experience of how each of the different cameras brings something different to what I see when I go to photograph something.
Yeah.
And like right now, as we're doing this, I'm scanning in photos from the Semi Leotex, and I'm just absolutely, you know, chuffed about the, you know, what I'm seeing. It's just like, I forgot about what a cool camera and how distinct it was to shoot with that camera, because it hasn't been in rotation for a while. But yeah, I don't keep things around that I don't want to shoot. And I will get very excited about, you know, traveling halfway around the world to go to a museum for a specific photo exhibit. You know, some of the exhibits that I've seen have been profoundly impactful in my life. Like I know that you picked up the catalog, the book for the exhibit that the Eastman House put together called The Art of Fixing a Shadow. You know, that's still like a highlight of my cultural life, is having gone to that exhibit at the Art Institute in Chicago.
Well, and your background in cinematography, I mean, you have an eye for it, and you're very, very good. In fact, my review that's going live tomorrow is for the Miranda Automex, which I loaned you.
Oh, I need to write you a little bit for that. That's a nice little dig.
Yeah, no. That wasn't why I was mentioning it. It was because I loaned Anthony this camera a couple years ago, and he shot like three rolls of film in it. And when I saw the results that he got with it, I was like, these are so much better than anything I can get with the same camera. So with your permission, I've only used your images in the review for that camera. So it's still a faithful review, because I did shoot it myself. So I speak to what it's like to use the camera, but I am handing over the photographic credits to somebody far more talented than I. So, you know, in fact, I would love to do that even more, because sometimes when I write my reviews, it's the actual shooting, the developing, the scanning that slows me down the most. I can sometimes churn out the history sections fairly quickly, but I have to actually use this camera before I feel like I can post something. And that often slows me down the most. That's not what we were going to talk about, was it?
No, but I'll probably jump in though and say I'm probably in between the both of you, because I really enjoy cameras which I can shoot a fair bit, and I do, and I use them for quite a considerable time when I actually do shoot them. I don't just sort of shoot them just for the review, because I actually like the results. I like going to galleries. I'm in fact heading one to one later this week, which is quite exciting.
And it's something I really enjoy doing, is actually shooting the cameras. But on the same note, I will also collect some because I like the collection and the history
Yeah.
and the machines themselves. So I'm sort of in between there. It's a little bit of a give and take. But if I couldn't shoot them, I'd probably, to be honest, walk away, because that's to me, the link into the photography is being able to shoot them and enjoy them, rather than just collecting, which is why I stopped collecting watches, because I kind of figured I can't wear watches, all these different watches all the time. And
right.
and the same with, I would never collect stamps or anything like that, as you said, because you can't use them.
Well, I would agree with you, because how you and I first met was through your site. And I liked Photo Thinking because your writing style was what I thought closest to what I do of any other people out there. You did include like history, a little bit about the history and a little bit about like why this camera is important or significant. But then you're a talented photographer, and you would spend, a couple months shooting a camera. And I liked that kind of approach, because a lot of the blogs out there, sometimes they barely scratch the surface of using the camera, and they don't even mention the history. Some people are all about the results. Stephen Dowling, I think, says he wants to spend months with a camera before he feels comfortable writing about it. And that's totally fine. Like, there's nothing wrong with that. But for me, I shoot sometimes one roll and that's it. Like, I don't have an interest in pumping out five different, images or five different rolls of film through a Practica.
But you're upfront with it. That's the thing.
Right.
That's the difference. It's a different purpose.
Right. Exactly. So I agree with you. I think you're right in the middle. And then Paul, I don't know. Paul's just
Paul just sells stuff.
I'm not you guys are process oriented. I'm not. I'm goal oriented. I really don't care what I pick up and shoot with, because the image is what I'm after. But if it's not a fun camera to use, I don't want to use it.
Yeah.
Right now, I just spent the last 5 months putting together a kit of stuff to take to Ireland. We're going to be in Ireland for 5 weeks. So, and we go to take pictures. I mean, it's a photo trip. So, I mean, it's not unusual for us to be shooting 8 hours a day while we're out there. So I spent all this time, put together a kit with like two M10Rs, Leicas, and one M10 monochrome, and eight really good lenses from 12 millimeters up to 75-1.5. And yesterday I decided I was going to take the Fujis, just because it's the image. I'm not getting the images that I want out of the M10, and I know I will out of the Fuji. So it was just a complete reversal on what I was doing. But it's the whole point for my photography is actually get an image I like, and what I shoot it to get that image is really sort of immaterial.
Gearwin posted in the chat, sounds like has an approach similar to me. He says, I only collect cameras I would be interested in using, but only use them because I like the collecting first of all. And that's a much shorter version of what I was trying to say. I mean, I started collecting and, used them because I had them, but I love the cameras themselves.
Well, Gearwin has so many cameras that, he would decimate the world supply of film if he would roll through each one of them.
I think there's people in this chat that have way more than I do. I would hope so.
You would hope, yeah.
I've seen your closet, Erwin. I know what you got. You have a great selection to choose from. A lot of people are very envious of the cameras that you come up with, because you got some great stuff.
Do you have like a specific brand or type that you prefer, or you just kind of like whatever tickles your fancy is what you have?
Well, basically everything. It started with mostly like I want to try something out, and then as my criteria were just I have to find it for cheap. That's it.
Yeah.
I didn't really care what brand or whatever it was. Apparently I got more into like the high-end stuff and the collectible stuff, because I obviously, you guys probably know that as well, the more you look for stuff, the more you find, obviously. So I went more into like the collectible and rarities stuff, and the one thing I find fun to collect is Leica, just because it pisses a lot of people off. I mean, it's just like I see people like posting like, oh yeah, I got this Leica for whatever, and hating on Leica, and I'm just here like, okay, I got 20 of them at this point in the past 3 years. Just making fun of all the snobs out there is what I live for at this point.
Anybody else have any thoughts on this?
I started my career shooting for newspapers, so that might explain what I know a little bit about film, for God's sakes. One of my fascinations is Kodak. So that's where I came up. When I saw Camerosity, I thought, aha, I know where you're coming from.
Yeah.
But I find great fascination with playing with little simple brownies and things like that. And a lot of people like the Lomo effect. They want to make it as awful as possible. You know, look, everything is blurred and out of focus. And I opened the camera back in the middle of the exposure. Now, I think it's sort of fun to see, you know, you can't get excellence, but you can get remarkably good stuff from some of these old guys. So that's my fascination.
Yeah.
I like to collect a lot of weird FD mount lenses for the Canon system.
Your Canon, yeah.
Yeah, I have more lenses than I have cameras. And I have a couple. I like a lot of weird wide angle lenses.
Okay, when you say weird, what do you mean? Give us an example.
Like, I mean lenses that aren't optically perfect, where they have weird like chromatic aberration and vignetting and have weird characteristics. I have a Samyang Phoenix 18 to 28, where like actually it's a 17 to 25, and when it's at 18, it's not sharp at all. But it gives such an interesting, dreamy look to my photos. Like, it flares like crazy. It has awful chromatic aberration in the corners. But I love using it. And I have one of those older, like, mid-70s Sigma Filtermatic fisheyes. It has, like, a bunch of filters in it.
No, those are good lenses.
Yeah, well, mine is not in good condition. It's got a bit of fungus, so it has some weird contrast. But I still use it because... I mainly use it for black and white because it has like the yellow and orange filters in it, but I get some really crazy effects with it due to the fungus. Like, it has weird hazing and interesting flaring due to how bad the glass is on the inside.
And it's surprising. Even lenses that look beat up can get remarkably good results. It's fascinating.
You know, in the spirit of FD mounts, Paul, I have a lens on my F1, which is a camera of the 70s. But you had told me you knew a little bit more about this lens than I did, but it's the 35 millimeter F2 Canon lens, but there's like four different variations of this lens. And this one is the one with the concave front element.
Oh, is that right. The aspherical one?
Yeah, that's the aspherical. Well, yes, that's the concave front element is the prime. That's the premier lens.
So what is it about this lens that makes it more desirable than later versions that aren't like that? Is it just the optical formula, or is there
it's the optics. You know, it's a combination of two things. It's a combination of the optics and the rarity. I mean, honestly, because it's a very rare lens, and because of that, people want them. But it also is capable of taking great pictures.
I think that specific line of FD lenses weren't around for too long until they introduced the new FD line. Like, I have the 50mm 1.4 SSC from that same period, and it's such a beautifully sharp lens.
Well, the 51.4 steel nose, is that, that's not the steel nose?
I'm not sure.
I think the steel nose is the first version. That one is really, really good too.
I think I do have that one actually.
No, that's a good one.
Yeah, it's so beautiful for portraits.
An interesting thing about this lens, I had this body, but this lens came from Kurt, and when I found it in the box, I was sure it had a yellow filter on it. Because you'd look through it and it was the yellowest lens I'd ever seen. I'm like, well, how is there a filter on this thing? There wasn't. It just was. It was ridiculous. Like, think of a Takumar. Like, a lot of the old Takumars usually have a little bit of yellowing.
Well, they're thorium or LIK9.
But Paul, this lens, I'm not exaggerating. It looked like it had a straight up yellow filter on it. It was that dark.
Yeah, it's gonna have that. It partly the coating.
Yeah.
It's either it's a thorium or a lanthanum.
I went on Amazon and I bought like an industrial grade UV lamp. Like, it came in a metal housing with like a metal bracket on it. And I just said, what the hell, you know? And I bought this thing. I wrapped the lens in foil. Like, I wrapped the back of it and I created like a little cradle so that like the light wasn't physically touching the lens, but almost all of the UV light was directed in it. And I just let it sit there for like 2 days. And honest to God, it worked great. Like it, the yellowing is almost completely gone. I did a before and after, and it doesn't look real. Like I couldn't believe how much it got rid of the yellowing. So
it just decreased the value of the lens by about $400 though.
Probably. But I tell you what, like it was so yellow, it actually made looking through the viewfinder a little bit darker.
Did it really?
Yeah. I mean, it now I look through the viewfinder, it just looks like any old 35 millimeter lens. Like
it's a good lens.
Yeah. It's, I think optically it's still good, but I got rid of the yellowing.
You know, it's funny when you were talking about that lens, it's a breech lock, isn't it?
Right. Yeah, they're breech lock.
Yeah, they're breech.
Not the new FD.
We were talking about the cameras of the 70s, and probably the two most reliable, coolest cameras from the 70s were Canons that nobody really pays any attention to, and that was the TLB and the FTB.
Oh, those are fantastic.
They're great cameras, and
they're really they got cheap.
So
too.
Little respect.
They get no respect.
Was that before the Canon F came along?
No.
Or was that concurrent?
Well, I shouldn't say that.
The F1 was about the same time frame.
Yeah, pretty similar. I mean, that is Canon's equivalent to the Nikkor Mat.
Right? Yeah, they were the first step down. I mean,
the F1 was never Canon at that time was not really known as a professional camera. I mean, they had the F1, but it wasn't really a competitor to Nikon at that time. But the TLB and the FTB were the first two cameras that used open aperture metering. So they were the first cameras to use the FD lenses. Before that, you had the FT and the TL, both of which used FL lenses and were stop down metering. So when they came out in the 70s with the TLB and the FTB, and they used the FD lenses, they'd use the FL lenses also, but it was stop down metering. So you had to push in your depth of field preview to get a meter reading. But those were really good cameras. They were very reliable. They were heavy as hell.
Yeah.
But they really worked well and they held up.
Those came out with, that was around the time the Pelix had it too, that quick load system that worked really, really well. It had that like chrome flap inside the film compartment that you would just kind of start your leader on it and you would like just barely close the door and this flap would just trap the film and prevent it from backing off. And it worked so well. Obviously, automatic film loading negated the need for that. But to my knowledge, no other company attempted to do what Canon did with that little chrome door.
I think they did that with their like QL rangefinders too.
The G3 had it also. Mm-hmm. But you're right. It was a great thing.
It worked really well.
You remember that? I don't know if you've ever seen one, but if you look, find a camera that's still in the box. There was a little piece of clear plastic that had three fingers that showed you where you were supposed to put your fingers, and you loaded the film out and you left that there. And I can't tell you how many people got their first roll of film and they all had three fingers on them because they didn't take the piece of plastic out of the back of the camera.
Oh, too funny.
The mention of the Canon Pelix, I always thought that was fascinating. And it never really seemed, if I'm not mistaken, they had two versions of that, but it never really took off. And I have often wondered, did that eat up too much light? Was it too delicate? Because you can see there are benefits to not having a mirror flapping away.
Yeah, both of those things. It was complicated. It wasn't bright. They did come out with a 1-2 lens to try to help it.
You got to do what you got to do.
They haven't held up well. Mike, how many of you had that actually worked?
They almost never worked. The issue is the reflex mirror, light has to pass through it. And if that reflective material gets any dirt, damage, anything, it immediately impacts your images.
And plus, it's just out there floating around in space. I imagine it collected crap like nobody's business every time you change a lens.
Dust on the mirror is now in your photos. But to say that it didn't last isn't entirely true either, because while it's true, yes, there was never a Pelix II, mm-hmm. and they stopped using that feature on their consumer grades. Both Canon and Nikon continued to use Pelix mirrors, pellicle mirrors, until like the late 90s. I have a Canon EOS 1NRS, I think, was there for a brief moment. I think it was like the 88 Olympics. It was one of the Olympics. I can't remember which one it was, but Canon and Nikon went head to head in like a speed war, and they wanted to have the 35 millimeter SLR that could shoot the fastest frames per second by having to move a mirror up and down, slowed it down. So they made some of these high speed cameras for professional use only that had a pellicle mirror, so that by eliminating the mirror moving at all, it gave them, I think, up to like 14 frames per second or something. They managed to get it up to with a film camera, which is pretty insane.
So if that was EOS, that was autofocus. So that's the way you get past, okay, it's a bit of a dim image, but it's autofocus. You're just using it to frame, right? Okay.
I did a comparison where I took the EOS One with the pellicle mirror and I compared it to just some other Canon I had. I think it was a T90. It was like, they're not exactly contemporary, but close enough. And I set my smartphone to manual mode. So everything was the same exact exposure. I even used the same lens on the two cameras. Well, it couldn't have been a T90 because that's not the right mount. Whatever it was I used, it was some other camera that I could use the same lens on. And I did an A-B comparison using my smartphone through the viewfinder. And the pellicle one was definitely darker. I mean, you can see it, but it's not that bad. I tell you what, there's something neat about this. Neither of these cameras are from the 70s, by the way. But when you're holding an SLR to your eye and you're hearing the shutter firing and you're not getting any viewfinder blackout, it's kind of cool. Like it's
pretty cool.
It tricks your brain into thinking something's different. You know, in fact, it almost feels like the camera's not working at all, but it is. So
one thing I never understood with those though is if it's not moving the mirror out of the way, isn't it less light getting the film? So are you underexposing the film then, or are you
on the Pellix? I don't know about the later ones, but only I think 40% of the light is being reflected up, I think. And even though that sounds like a lot, it comes to like a third of a stop is all you're losing.
Yeah, if you're using through the lens metering, it takes it and it's calibrated for it.
It's calibrated for
it. If you're using a handheld meter, you probably want to overexpose at least about a half a stop.
And of course, movie cameras had, prism, that sort of thing. That was, most of amateur movie cameras that had through the lens would have to do it. Not a Pellix necessarily, but a prism of some sort. So I guess.
And then even in the late or early 2010s, Sony released one of their first mirrorless cameras, still had a reflex viewfinder. I can't remember the series of what they called it, but they basically took that same concept, but in the digital world too. So companies have dabbled with the idea of a pellicle mirror time and time again, and it does work. It's just, it doesn't, in my opinion, give you the advantage you would think it does. Like you would think, oh, doesn't it make them super quiet? No, not really. Fire a Pellix next to an FTB and they don't sound a whole lot different. Like
one of those things that are like good on paper, but concept is like, oh, okay.
Right. And I think that's why it never really took off, is because besides the idea of that speed war of how many frames per second can we get, other than that one advantage, there's almost no advantage to the pellicle mirror that a normal camera wouldn't already have. I mean,
and it's delicate.
Right. Exactly. The downsides are much higher than the upsides. And, does anybody, like for those of us who go back and forth between digital and film cameras, like let's say you take a digital mirrorless and then you go back to a film SLR, does that 1/80th of a second viewfinder blackout, does it really make a difference? I would say, 98% of the time it does not. So eliminating the viewfinder blackout, it's a novelty. It's definitely cool. And I'm sure there are specific incidences where it does come in handy, but it's just not that big of a deal.
Yeah.
But cool.
Okay. Changing direction a little bit and taking us back to the 70s. I probably want to sort of let's see with Anthony. I think Anthony, you were in your prime in the 70s, weren't you, mate?
I don't think that I was in my prime, but I certainly
by junior high. Yeah. He was in junior high then.
I mean, I graduated high school in 81, so definitely with junior high years. I mean, I was skateboarding in empty pools and going to see the Ramones, and I actually have photos up on Flickr because I snuck out my dad's Olympus RC and got photos of like the first Blondie tour and the first Pretender show in the United States. So that was like 78, 77, but I hope that's not my prime.
I remember in the 70s, you could take pretty much any camera into a concert. That was not an issue.
Oh, absolutely.
I remember shooting. I had a Nikkormat back in the day, but I remember shooting Bruce Springsteen with a 200 millimeter Nikkor. I mean, it's an obvious camera. No one cared in the slightest. Those were the days.
Well, the very first concert that I ever saw, my older brother, who was 5 years older than I was, he wanted to go to a show. And my mom was like, well, you have to take your little brother if you're going to borrow the car. That was a way to get me out of the house so that she could have a night to herself. And it was a triple bill with the Atlanta Rhythm Section, Bob Seger, and Kiss.
Oh, wow.
And my brother took my dad's Kodak Retina Reflex 3 or 4. I think it's 4 with the 135 millimeter lens and just stood there taking pictures of Gene Simmons all night long on Kodachrome. And so my very first concert experience was taking photos, well, being with my brother, taking photos of Kiss, and then just marveling at those photos when he got the film back.
Fantastic. So you mentioned the Olympus RC was something you used at that time. I mean,
absolutely.
They're interesting camera, those fixed lens rangefinders from Olympus, actually.
They're all 1970s products. There's the SP, which was a bit above my pay grade when I was in 7th grade, and the RC, and then the what was the cheaper one, Mike? Was it the EC?
EC.
There was an EC, there was an RD. The EC was the cheaper one, though.
But they're fantastic cameras. Absolutely fantastic. That's actually on my short list of cameras from the 70s I wanted to talk about. Is that RC went on all my first vacations, all of me, that was like the first camera, because my dad pretty much just gave that to me and he bought himself a nicer camera. Don't remember what that was.
In the chat, Daniel says the Olympus RC is fantastic. Daniel, is that a camera you have experience with?
Yeah, it's one of my earlier cameras that I was able to pick up. I am a collector first, but I do have to test each camera. I've done two rolls to the RC at this point. And somehow most of the images come out fantastic. In focus, sharp, colors are great. It's a great camera. It's such a compact camera as well. You can just take it wherever you'd like.
Do those use the 675 batteries? The Mercury, they were the old Mercury batteries, but there's a hearing aid battery replacement, AG1, I think.
I believe they might be the like wine cell batteries. I have to double check, but...
I think there's... You can use the wine cells, but you can also get the a hearing aid battery. It's a zinc air, but they're dirt cheap. But they don't last a long time.
And you just get a spacer.
It's a little voltage. Sleeve with a little sleeve that makes them fit.
Okay,
but yeah, I think it was a sort of like a shape of things to come with those lenses on those fixed rangefinders, because I believe they predate the OM1 and the Zuiko lenses for the OM1, and they're compact and sharp. And, they definitely punch above their weight, so to speak.
The OM-1 was early 70s, too. So it's possible, they were making the optics for the rangefinder cameras, the same line they were using to make the Zuikos.
Well, you're in good company shooting the Olympus 35 RC, because one of the most famous camera bloggers ever on the internet is a huge fan. Mr. Ken Rockwell has a review of the RC, and he says...
Fantastic.
The Olympus 35 RC seems like a trivial little rangefinder camera. However, it's an astoundingly great performer. Not only does it perform magnificently, it's possibly the smallest 35 millimeter rangefinder camera ever made with auto and manual exposure settings. Debatable. Compared to a Leica M7, the Olympus 35 RC feels cheap and dinky, but it's also easier to use and faster to shoot and gives the same results. It may feel dinky, but my 35 RC has turned out to be far more reliable and dependable than my Leica M7, and the 35 RC is far faster to load too. So
do we need to do a disclaimer? He's going to send us a bill,
Yeah, yeah. A cease and desist. That could quite possibly be the world's only Olympus 35 RC versus Leica M7 review, but you heard it right here. No, it seems like nobody dislikes that camera. So
I hope you have dramatic theme music that you can bed that with as you're reading it.
I'll do the Superman theme song.
That's actually a camera I have my eyes on of collecting.
Oh, they're cheap too. They're dirt cheap.
Yeah, get it while it's still cheap.
We won't post this episode until probably Friday or Saturday, so you guys have until then before the prices start to skyrocket on them.
We were talking about Canon earlier, and I actually have a pretty historically significant Canon camera from the 70s. I have an early production model number Canon A1. I think is one of the first SLR to have the four common settings that we have today, which is like program, aperture, priority, shutter, and manual.
Yeah, the A1 was, Mike, look it up there. It wasn't that late 70s, early 80s?
78.
Early, okay. 78. Yeah, I'm sorry, Jordan, I misheard you.
Yeah, it's. I love using this camera. It's actually my main 35 millimeter.
Are you eating?
Yeah, sorry.
No, it's okay.
I've used a couple of Nikons before, and I really like Nikons, but there's something about the tactile feel of using this camera and where all the buttons and lever, all the knobs and stuff are placed on this. That's like, I can literally change settings with one hand.
My favorite part of that camera is the red LED display.
Yeah.
Like I love those LEDs.
The old Mattel football game where it like just beeps, but it has all little red LEDs. I love those.
Yeah. And the meter in this thing is shockingly really accurate.
Yeah.
The shutter on it though, the shutter, when you fire it, it just sounds like a complete set of aluminum pots and pans falling down a flight of concrete stairs.
I don't mind the shutter sound though.
It just doesn't sound good. I mean, it's chintzy,
yeah,
but it's a good camera. I mean, it was very reliable. You know, it was the time where if you sold one of those things, you always sold an extra battery with it because,
yeah,
you know, it was the beginning of the era where you had battery dependent cameras.
Yeah, the batteries for this actually last a while.
They do. Yeah, it's not hard on batteries.
I had one last like 8 months. I was like, oh, wow.
The current batteries, though, for the camera, the 544s, you know, they're actually dog collar training batteries, and they don't last very long.
When did the Minolta XT11 come out? Was that before the A1, or was it after? 77.
Same year. Oh,
yeah, 77 or 79, 79.
Because that you had said it was the first camera to have the PSAM. Minolta only has a aperture priority and shutter priority, but it can't do program. So
yeah,
I think you might be right.
My camera is actually pretty cool because it was manufactured the month before they actually sold it, and it's number 1,737 out of, like, I think they made like 2 million of them.
A lot. Yeah, they made quite a few,
which that's pretty nice. I mean, it's in beautiful shape too.
Ironically, the A1 is one that I do not have. I've had two of them over the years and both had issues, and I got rid of them.
What was the issues?
One of them, the curtain was just physically damaged. I ended up buying it from someone, returning it, and the other one just wouldn't turn on. Like, it was just dead, completely dead.
Oh, wow.
I don't know what it is with the A1s, but I have, like, and I know most camera technicians have boxes full of them.
Yeah.
They just, like, it's a thing. Like, AE1s are pretty easy to repair, but like A1s have like these issues that God knows why. And I'm looking at like a box of 10 of them that I don't even want to start repairing because they're not that reliable.
I've actually talked to a lot of technicians who I'm friends with who are like, I do not work on A1s. I will not work on them.
I mean, they're not fun at all.
Yeah.
I think it's just like anything though. They had too much technology too early on. Theo, again, I'm jumping decades here, but you were mulling taking the Nikon FA to Vietnam. And first I thought it was going to be the only one you were taking, and I was advising you against it because the FA is similar in that it had a crap ton of new state-of-the-art technology, which hasn't held up as reliably. And when they do fail, they're just, you can't fix them. So I think that's the same kind of problem that the A1 had. But you had mentioned the AE1. So let's talk about that camera for a little bit, because of any SLR for non-collectors, but people who liked film photography, it seems like the AE1, and I'm grouping the AE1 program in too, but that is without a doubt one of the most popular SLRs ever made. I'm not saying it's the best. It's not my favorite. It's not the worst.
It's popular because it's really easy to use.
Yeah, and you mentioned that even if they break, they're usually fixable. You know, they're very susceptible to the mirror squeak, which it's not even the mirror, it's some kind of pin or something, isn't it?
It's actually the gearing to the side that moves the mirror up, but it's not even an issue. It's just a sound problem.
And if somebody ever tells you to fix it with WD-40, shoot them in the face. No, do not put WD-40 anywhere near a camera. Definitely not. But no, the AE1, I mean, my biggest gripe with it is I'm just not a huge shutter priority fan.
Same.
I have cameras that have it that I'll use. I mean, there's nothing wrong with it. I'm either going to use program where I just want the camera to do everything, or I want to do aperture priority. Like, I feel just the way my brain works, I want to control the depth of field more so than, oh, I must shoot it 1/125th. So, but I mean, other than that, it's a fine camera. You know, I mean, there's nothing great about it. It supports, Canon has excellent lenses. You're going to get great images from it.
Yeah.
But, you know, it was super pioneering, because when it came out, you know, Canon, I think, realized with the failure of the Canon Flex, they can't compete with Nikon at the pro market. The middle of the market quickly filled up. You know, Canon was in there with Minolta, Konica, Yashica, Miranda for a while. Then Olympus jumped in 71, and Canon was making the TLBs and the FTBs and the Pelixes and such, and they were good cameras, but you know, they weren't doing anything to really differentiate. And then they decided to come out with the new AE series, because they had the AT1, the AV1, there was an AL1. But the AE1, you know, clearly was the most popular one, and it shrunk the size of the body. They used more composite materials, you know, a little bit more plastic, made it a little bit more lighter weight. Beyond the poor location of the battery compartment, which is a huge weak point of that camera, I mean, besides that, pretty decent little camera. There's nothing wrong with it.
Did that motivate Nikon to come out with the FM series, or was Nikon already making the FMs when the AE1?
I think they made it after.
That's what I'm thinking, that Nikon said, oh my God, they're beating us in this. And so the FM, because the FM was always the sort of the small.
Yeah, the FM2 is 1982.
Oh, all right.
The whole FM series, I have an FE here.
Yeah.
That was actually inspired by the OM system, because,
okay. Right.
I mean, Nikon was making stuff like this. This is a Nichromat EL here.
I remember.
They're making stuff like this. And these, this is a full-size SLR. It's pretty heavy. Yeah. Olympus came to the market with these nice, easy-to-use, smooth, little tiny SLRs. And Nikon's like, whoa, what are we doing here? We're still making, you know, these relics of the past. Mm-hmm. And they came out with the new stuff. And if you've ever held a Nichromat next to one of the FM derivatives, you can really feel like the Nichromat feels old. The FM ones feel distinctly modern. And bigger, you know, brighter viewfinder, much smaller, easier to use. So,
and they had an excellent little motor for the FMs, which was nice.
Yeah. And I have the MD12 here. Best motor drive here.
Nikon was very conscientious of not sacrificing the pro market, which is, when you get into the Nichromats, the reason they're called Nichromats and not Nikons is they did not want people to mistake a Nichromat for a Nikon.
Right.
It wasn't until the EL2, the EL2 is a Nichromat. Just they called it the Nikon EL2. For whatever reason, they finally made a corporate policy change in 1976 or 77 and allowed the Nikon EL2 to be called the Nikon. But all previous Nichromats were called Nichromat because they were that concerned with you know, sacrificing, confusing the market or whatever.
Right.
But in addition to that, though, if you look at Nikon, honestly, even till through today, look at how long it took Nikon to make the Z series with the digital mirrorless. Like, Nikon rarely, and I'm talking, if you really think about this, throughout the history of them making cameras, they rarely innovated. They were rarely the first one to the market with something. They did it on occasion, but they always waited to see what the market wanted before they released stuff. Their first point and shoot, the Pikachu, whatever it was called, didn't come out till like 82, 83, several years after Konica released one. The FM and the FE came out in, I think, 77 and 78 respectively. So to answer your question, they did come out after the AE1, but I wouldn't say that the AE1 inspired them to do it. I think they were already working on it. Nikon did not add autofocus early. The original F stayed in production from 59 to like 72 because they couldn't, they just kept selling them. Like, they didn't want to change it. And when the F2 came out, it was just incremental changes. The F3 was a radical departure, but that was 80 when the F3 came out. So when you look at Nikon's history, they usually were behind other companies in terms of new technologies, shrinking their cameras down, using composite materials, titanium curtains. You know, the FA has the 1/4,000th of a second top shutter speed like the FM2 does, but the F3 didn't. They didn't want to put it like they were willing to keep a slightly slower shutter if it meant protecting what the pros knew and were already used to, rather than saying, hey, we have this awesome new feature. We haven't tested it. We don't know if it's going to hold up, but you know, so that's, it's, you know, it's interesting, like from a standpoint where Nikon rarely innovated, they usually reacted, but when they did, it was purposeful and, you know, to help them stay on at the top of the market.
Mike, if I can hijack things here.
Yeah.
Cue the Space Age Bachelor Pad music. Because if there's one camera manufacturer that was focused on innovation in the 1970s and focusing on breaking the norm, it's the decade of Polaroid.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, you know, yeah. The most exciting things that Polaroid ever put together came out in the 1970s. And for me, my dad, being the good orthodontist that he was one of the first people on the block to have an SX-70 to take pictures of his patients as they would finish their orthodontic treatment, and they'd have this like perfect grin, and he'd take their picture and put it up on the wall. And then that became my camera, which I loved when I could afford to shoot it. But boy, even back then in the 70s, it was expensive to shoot SX-70. It was never an affordable format.
No, it wasn't.
But the innovations of the SX-70, and then the other camera that he gave me that I just loved shooting, and it was fantastic at parties, was the Big Shot, which is just a big, it's basically a mugshot camera. It's a big chunk of plastic with a flashbulb diffuser at the end, fixed focus, fixed shutter.
The largest viewfinder ever on a camera.
Designed for one thing, and it was to take portraits, which is why it was also Andy Warhol's favorite tool. I mean, I've actually been to an exhibit before of silkscreen paintings that he had done of nothing but Big Shot images that he had taken. But for me, as a kid who was just getting into photography, that was the most exciting thing about the 1970s, were, you know, the innovations that came up through Polaroid.
Well, it surely was, because it would kick out an image that would develop. You didn't have to peel it apart. So I fully remember that. My dad had one, and we still have it. But the fact that it would kick out a thing that would come out sort of vaguely opaque and then evolve into an image, that was amazing.
Sure. I mean, in some ways, Polaroid was the opposite of Nikon. Nikon wasn't a risk taker, but Polaroid was. You know, we've mentioned this before, but Edwin Land was like, or I should say, Steve Jobs was the Edwin Land, you know, of our generation. But Edwin Land was just an innovative guy, and he imagined stuff and made it happen.
Yeah, there's so many Polaroid models, like.
There's all sorts of innovative stuff. The SX-70, the mirror is some sort of amazing shape, and just to make an SLR that size, there's all sorts of amazing stuff going on.
People always think of the Minolta Maxim from 85 as the first autofocus 35mm SLR, but who made the first autofocus SLR?
Yes,
Polaroid with the sonar. Yeah. It wasn't 35mm, but it was an SLR, and it was autofocus. And So that I don't keep talking, does anyone want to explain how the autofocus system worked on that camera?
Yeah, I have one right here in my hand. Basically, you have this big tumor on the top of the lens board here, and there's this golden disc here, and that's actually a transducer. It's both a speaker and a microphone. So it puts out this little click. If you put your ear right up to it, you can barely hear it if you have good hearing. And that basically, like a bat sort of, it's sonar. It puts out this supersonic signal that you can't hear. And it bounces off of whatever is in front of it. That includes windows. And it comes back to the camera. And it times the amount of time that it takes for that signal to return to the camera. And it rotates the lens with the motor that's inside of it. Now, there is a button above the focus wheel that you can press and override the autofocus. And that's for things like if you have a window.
Through the window.
Yeah, glass will fool it.
So that's, glass is its biggest weakness. But what is the biggest benefit of a sonar autofocus?
You can use this in pitch darkness, and that's pretty cool. And it's also, I will say, this is from the mid-70s, and man, the autofocus on this is lightning fast. So whatever they did with the circuitry on this is excellent.
Yeah. Yeah, it works in complete darkness, which is super cool.
Is that, which version is that? Is that an SX-70 sonar?
It's the SX-70 Land Camera Sonar One Step.
So, Okay.
Yeah, with the red button.
Do those work on mirrors as well? I think they, with the sonar.
The mirror will fool it off. It'll focus halfway.
It'll focus on the physical mirror itself, not the reflection.
Right. So you'd have to press the little button here to override that and manually focus it.
Now, it's very clever, probably based upon what they could do. I'm sure they played around with other options. Like, I know Leica had a thing where they measured contrast, but that takes a lot of expensive circuitry. You know, it's remarkable with the electronic development they had in the 70s. I mean, it's probably the most clever way to do it.
Well, Leica did develop an autofocus system for
I know, but they never put it to market, I understand. And I imagine it was being Leica. It wasn't cheap, I would bet.
Well, I think Leica stopped it because they were like, well, we don't want to ruin the market of manual focus SLRs. I don't think anyone wants autofocus.
That's, you know, that's
people
exactly
wanted autofocus.
They just assumed that a Leica customer would turn their nose up at autofocus. And they were probably right, to be honest with you. But, and yes, I guarantee it would have been expensive as hell. But yeah, and I mean, it doesn't work. It's sound. So, I mean, anything like a window or anything, any glass where sound is going to reflect off of it, that's what it's hearing. And that's, it's measuring. I mean, I don't know that it's true sonar, like what submarines use, but it's the same concept. A sound is emitted and then the speaker listens for the reflection of it to come back. And whatever that delay is in time, that's how it knows the distance of what the sound bounced off of it should focus on. So it can't see through anything that light can pass through.
The the accuracy of the focus should be very good. I mean, compared to the other systems that
the day,
you know, triangulation.
Right.
And
the accuracy is excellent, except since you have the big a disc above the lens, you have actually a parallax. So this will actually focus to 1.5, no, one foot. It'll focus to 1 foot. And by then the parallax actually takes place. So you kind of have to search around if you're really close up. Which is not something really you're used to if you're doing most autofocus cameras, especially SLRs.
Oh, yeah.
So that's just something to be mindful of.
A 1 foot autofocus is impressive even by today's standards.
And remember, they put the battery in the film, so you'd always have a fresh battery.
Right.
Yeah.
That was, we laugh at, being economically friendly, and definitely weren't.
Or environmentally.
That explains the cost of SX70 packs, though. I mean, if the battery's right in there, you're paying for that as well.
Well, and that new, what do they call it? The I-Type, the new Polaroid Originals I-Type, that does not have a battery in it. That's one of the things they took out. You charge the camera. So I remember reading somewhere about when they designed the SX70, why they put the battery in the cassette rather than the camera. I guess the thought was you're more likely to change film than you are to change the battery so that you'd never run out of power. But then you have to account for somebody who doesn't finish their roll right away. So like, what should the shelf life be of a half shot pack of film? If that battery dies, then you can't even finish the pack of film.
And I wonder if that motor didn't eat up a lot of energy. So they would be running out of battery power if you didn't replace the battery with the film.
Well, that's part of it for sure, Patrick. It's a 5.6 volt battery. I've had cameras that came to me with film in them that I know have been in there for 2 or 3 years and the batteries were still good.
Mm-hmm.
So it must be some formulation of a battery that lasted for a long time. For a while, Polaroid actually sold those batteries separately and for some instruments that they had that you could replace with the same type battery that was in that film pack.
And it's even possible to swap the film in a dark room. You could, in theory, take the unexposed pieces out and put them in a pack with a good battery if you really wanted to.
There is one guy out here in Australia, I think he's out in Perth now, who actually does modify the SX70s to actually use I think it's a rechargeable USB battery. So you can actually use the new I-Type film in the SX70 with a camera that's rechargeable, so that way you're not having to sort of pay the premium of getting or the environmental cost of having to get the batteries in the film packs each time.
Are they change? Is the ISO the same on I-Type as it is in SX70, or does he modify the meter as well?
He does modify meters. I don't know in terms of because of the film or not. That's probably, I'm reaching the limit of my knowledge here. But
the I-Type film is actually 600 speed. So it's identical film to that of Type 600, just without the battery.
Yeah. So he's obviously modifying the meter then as well, because he does that you can ask for that as a separate piece of work as well. So he does do that. So I've actually got two SX-70, one that's in really bad shape, which I'm going to have totally recovered and redone. And I'm in my favorite football team's colors, but at the same time, have it modified to the 600 fill. And I do have a more traditional one, which I held up a moment ago, which with the brown leather, which I'll just have serviced and leave that as an SX-70. So that way I've got the best of both worlds.
What is the iFilm, is it Impossible or is it Zinc? Who makes it? Do you know?
Impossible.
Is it Impossible? I picked up from Kurt one of the little Polaroids that uses the Zinc film, and that's sort of a dye sub material. But it's really good. I mean, the picture quality on it is excellent.
The Zinc is actually, if I remember correctly, it's a thermal paper, and depending on the temperature, it changes different colors.
Yeah, I mean, I haven't tried it at any except room temperature, but the result on it was really good.
Yeah, I have a little printer that uses the Zinc paper, one of those little Canon selfies, I think they're called, and you can just sort of wirelessly send stuff from your phone, and it prints basically on that Zinc paper, and it's really nice. There is a question around fading on those, though, so I'm not quite sure if that's the problem with them.
Yeah, heat or UV will definitely bleach them. I know that from experience.
For the SX-70, if you ever pick one up, for anybody listening, because you don't have to replace the battery, that's usually not a concern, but getting them cleaned, getting those rollers cleaned is critical for them to work properly. And I've heard stories that there's a little spring in the back of the film compartment that's actually what like pushes the dark slide in each exposure out, that can become weakened over time. But apart from that spring and making sure they're cleaned, they're very bulletproof. The bellows are rubber, so unless someone has like poked their finger through it, they're not likely to have light leaks. And the electronics seem to have held up well too. So in addition to being technologically innovative, all around cool looking cameras that are fun to use, they do tend to hold up pretty well.
And they manufactured in the United States, which is also fascinating.
Yeah.
If I'm not mistaken, or did they outsource that?
No, they were made here.
That's
amazing. The thing about the SX-70 is if you ever get one and you go to close it and it doesn't want to close, don't force it, because what's happened is the battery ran down while the mirror was still in the up position, and it won't close. If you try to close it and you feel any resistance at all, stop. Put a fresh pack of film in it and it'll reset itself, and then you can close it.
I think I've told this story before, but I had my dad's SX-70 that I'd shot since I was in high school. And a couple of years ago before COVID, I was in Seattle, and there was a guy there that was the West Coast guy that everybody raved about as the best person to have work done on your SX-70. And so I dropped it off in person, and he ran through all of the work he was going to do on it and the restoration, and he's going to reskin it with new leather. And I waited for him to ship the camera back to me. And by the time I got back to Florida, he had gone out of business and absconded with every camera that had been dropped off with him and awful. Never surfaced again. Like nobody, like you can still go on Google reviews and just scathing reviews for all the cameras that he walked off with. So my dad's SX-70 is gone with the wind. So, you know, the other great innovation of the 1970s, and I know this is something that Paul will want to weigh in on, is 110.
Oh, yeah.
And
As
somebody who's like it's kind of a fanatic on sub miniature cameras, you know, I think that the smaller formats often get a bad rap,
and rightfully so.
Almost all of the 110 cameras were crap, but there were some really good ones out there too.
Oh yeah.
I mean, I assume that maybe within a few years of when they were made, the Rolly 110 were good. Now I can't find one that works. I've probably been through 10 and haven't found a single one that still works. But the Minox 110 is fantastic. And so is the Voigtlander Vidarete 110. And of course, then there's the Pentax and there's the Minolta.
I really wanted to not like the Pentax Auto 110, but gosh darn it, it's pretty fun to use. I do like it. I don't know why.
I think even the Instamatic 50 and 60 were quite good, especially the 60 with a rangefinder.
Yeah, the Canon 110 ED was probably the best.
I was going to say the Canon 110 ED is, they called them the candy bar cameras. To me, that's my favorite one. It's an F2 lens, I think like 6 elements. It's got auto exposure. The ED, the D means date, so it can do a date stamp. Coupled rangefinder. I mean, it's solid. It's mostly metal.
What I've always wondered about the 110 cameras is, all right, Eastman Kodak is cranking out 126 Instamatics. Were sales slowing on that? They said we need a new format. I've heard they said, oh, we want something smaller. Did they really have market research to say the market wants smaller? I've never completely understood why they decided, let's 126 has run its course. Let's come up with something new.
Well, I mean, look at Kodak's model. They were a film company.
They needed
to make as much film as possible.
Yep.
Even though technically Kodak invented the 35 millimeter like cassette, they didn't really invent the film. Like 35 millimeter predated Kodak. So Kodak was constantly looking for new ways to reinvent the wheel. And Instamatic, the original Instamatic 126, was kind of like their first real attempt at it. And it, you know, it sold okay. I mean, it did all right in the 60s, but I think even within a few years, it was clear this was never going to supplant the professional cameras. And because, you know, it had similar size film, they thought, well, if we really want to make something that appeals to novices and amateurs and children, we could make this even smaller. So I think the impetus to come up with the 110 format wasn't necessarily to replace 126. It was just that they realized that amateurs just didn't care about a large image. You know, and then they did the disc film, which was even smaller than 110. So Kodak had no qualms about making small negatives. And by being able to make the 110 cameras as small as they did, just opened them up to a market that they never had before.
Well, we've talked about this before too. The big advantage is that it forced them to make better film.
Right.
When you're working with a smaller piece of film, it better be a very high grade film.
If and, only they had someone invent digital for them and they could patent it.
The disc film, T grain film was invented for Kodak disc film. So
right.
While they likely would have invented it anyway, I don't think it's true to say if it wasn't for disc film, we wouldn't have T-Max. I assume they would have done it anyway. However, that was the market launch of T-Grain was for the disc film.
You know, we were talking about Pentax 110s. I actually spent $70 on an adapter to use the Pentax 110 lenses on Micro Four Thirds cameras.
Oh, yeah.
I wish you wouldn't have. I have like,
did you have one?
Yeah.
Oh, wait a minute. No, I'm wrong. I had one too. I got one from Kurt. I didn't spend the money on that.
I have like 10 of them.
Another one, but it wasn't that one.
Okay.
And the lens actually was pretty good. The problem is it doesn't have any apertures. I mean, it's a fixed aperture. So I was shooting with the 70 millimeter 2.8 and it's a little limiting not to be able to.
Let me ask this group or Tim or anybody who's done this before. Has anybody here developed their own 110 film?
I did back in the 70s, ironically.
Well, I'm at home.
I still do. I mean, I've got the reels for doing 16 millimeter, and it's just 16 millimeter film.
Yeah, it is just 16 mil.
I just crack open the cartridge and develop it myself. Yeah, I do all my own developing on 110.
Okay, and are they the metal reels or not? Like, they don't make a comparison.
Yeah, yes, the metal reels.
Okay.
I've got the Kiev reels because I've got the Kiev 16, the Kiev, whatever the 60 millimeter version of the Minolta 16 is, and it came with a plastic reel that is a bit like a Peterson reel. It works really well.
Yeah, those plastic, they used to be adjustable. They would have a snip. So some of them even go out to 616 and 116 film, but that's what I used.
Yeah, you can still buy really chintzy plastic reels. I think Yankee makes a tank like that. Okay. Yeah. Now, I don't necessarily recommend those because every Yankee tank I've had warped within the first year. But yeah, they're totally serviceable. And in my experience, it's not the developing that's the tough part. It's if you want to scan or print it using such small negatives are just such a pain to work with. Especially, you know, I don't have a film holder for my scanner for 110. So I had to sort of jury rig something for my 35 millimeter holder, make some masks and stuff. It's really a pain to work with the tiny
negatives. And printing, I mean, optical printing with an enlarger, if you would get that, you could probably find a short lens, like a 25 millimeter enlarging lens, but just doing it with a standard 50 millimeter, it was very, you know, you couldn't get bigger than a 5x7, and it was a real challenge because, again, you'd need a glass film holder and all these things. So it took some ingenuity.
It's not like you'd want to go more than 5x7 on 110 anyway, though.
Well, there's probably that.
Has no one released 110 cartridges with 16 millimeter motion picture film in it?
I thought I bought a roll of 110. I thought someone was.
You need the perforations need to be in a specific spot, or else
yeah.
A large. I've discussed this with Adam Paul, who I know has hacked a ton of 110 cameras, and he told me that through trial and error, there are only a very few number of 110 cameras that will work properly without that indexing pin there.
Yeah.
So it won't allow you to continue to fire the shutter unless it knows that the pin's in the right spot. So you could physically fit 16 millimeter motion picture film in like a reloadable cassette, but unless you get those holes in the right spot, the camera will just keep winding.
Now, if Lomo is still doing this, but Lomo at one point was making 110. I don't know if it's still in production.
They still are.
Yeah. They're the only people that actually still make it.
Okay.
Black and white and color. And they might make color slide. But they do. I know they make red scale too.
I think all of their films are on 110 now.
I've bought some of that before, and okay. they properly perforate it. So if you're into camera hacking, you have to figure out a way to do basically like a hole punch in the right spot to actually get most. Now there are some that will work. It is possible to modify some 110 cameras so that they'll just fire regardless if the pin's in the right spot or not. But like I've personally tried it on the Minolta 110 SLR. I tried it on that Canon 110 ED and I tried it on something else and it did not work in any of them. You have to have the right film. Even if you have the right cassette, you still need the right film. It just doesn't
work. You know what else I remember is Kodak made a mini carousel projector. And they put some effort into it, the condensers and the lenses. And I remember actually getting them processed. They would actually return them in little small little mounts that fit in little miniature carousel trays. And I never had one, but I understand that they actually worked quite well.
The projectors worked fine. What the problem was, it looked like hell if it was bigger than a 2x3 foot image.
Right, because I mean, even with Kodachrome, yeah.
Yeah, it was not good. You know, and then Kodak would also mount the 110 slides in 2x2 mounts if you ask them to.
I've got some, and you could even get a little adapter to fit.
Yeah, but you don't want to use that, Patrick, because that'll burn your slide projector up in a matter of minutes.
Is it because it can't get enough air circulation?
Yeah, it's too much heat buildup back into the projector. Wow.
Tim, you had mentioned scanning 110. Go to Target, get two of the cheapest picture frames. Make sure that they have glass, though, not acrylic. Throw away the frames, just take out the glass. Get some like electrical tape and just tape up the sides so you don't cut yourself. And then take your 110 film and just sandwich it in between the two pieces of glass. I know what you're thinking, Newton rings. I don't know why it doesn't happen. And then I just rest the two pieces of glass directly on to the surface of my flatbed scanner. And then I just scan strips of 110 that way and it works every time.
All right, I'll try that. That sounds smart, especially for the... I have some other non-standard roll film that's kind of... Yeah,
it works with 127. Yeah. It works if you want to do sprocket scans. I even use it when I use some really expired 35 millimeter that curls like crazy and will not stay in the normal holders. I've even used it on that too, and it works for everything. But just make sure you protect both your skin and the glass of your scanner. And I just use electrical tape. And I just tape it around the glass edges so it doesn't scratch anything. And you got to have both pieces because the bottom piece of glass has to raise the film slightly above the surface of the. You can't just simply put film on the scanner. You have to have the two pieces of glasses from the photo frame like a sandwich, and then you put your film in between there.
Is there something optically going on because you're raising that film up from where the scanner thinks it should be? But is that piece of glass?
If you look at a typical flatbed scanner, like I have Epson, if you look at the film holders, it's holding the film above the surface of the glass.
That's right. It's not in contact with the glass.
No,
that's
not.
The focus point. The focus point's about a millimeter or two above the actual plane.
Right. There we go.
When you put your in your scanning software, when you switch it between reflective and film mode, the focal whatever focus level is different.
There is a little hack through the Epson V850 where if you're scanning, I believe 8x10, where you actually have to put it on the glass, there is a mode where you can actually do it where it's directly on the actual glass itself. I'm not sure how that would work if you were putting on 110 or Minox or something like that on there, though. So
should still work.
Raising it makes more sense.
There's some company that makes professional film holders where you can tweak them. You can actually but
they haven't responded to emails in a long time. I wish they would, but I just ended up getting the Epson like wet scanner. And you just put it on holder mode and
it works great.
Hammy mounting fluid.
Daniel, is that the better scan holders?
Yes.
He's had a lot of health problems.
Gotcha.
But yeah, if you want to scan your own 110 or 127 or anything that you don't have a film holder for, go to a Target or whatever the Target equivalent is where you live, get two cheap photo frames and just make a sandwich and it works. I don't know why you don't get Newton rings, but I don't.
Here one says he has one of the oddest 110 cameras.
What is it?
Yeah. I don't know. So I've been on a binge, quote unquote, in the last year of getting 110 cameras. I mean, they were nothing that interesting to me until I found like the maroon or safari 110. Then lately I got this one, the transparent version of the Pentax 110 with the dummy version.
That's cool.
And then I found, it's not 70s, it's probably a bit later, but I've got this cutie.
It's a fox.
With the remote. So this was an advertising stunt from Nissan Duncan, a noodle company. So it's a remote controlled fox. The remote is like a noodle cup, right?
Oh my God.
It rides around, so it has wheels on the bottom.
So what, you can actually drive, you can drive this thing around a room and take remote pictures?
Yeah, and then this arm comes down, this little finger comes down, and it takes the picture. The only sad part is you have to manually wind it again. So you can take one picture, then drive it back, wind the film, and then, but yeah. It's probably one of the rarest, but also coolest 110 cameras out there.
That's awesome.
Try that with an AE-1.
If we're talking about weird 110s, I have a weird one here. The Fisher-Price 110. Despite what it looks like, it's a full-on Kodak one. It was made by Kodak in Rochester.
Yeah.
And it's goofy. I know it's goofy. It has rubber bumpers on it. It says Fisher-Price. It has the kitty strap. But it has a little level in the viewfinder to make sure that you're actually nice and horizontal when you're taking it.
That was my first camera. I had one of those.
These things rock. It's not from the 70s. It's from 1985. But these things rock. So if you ever see one of these, like I've seen a whole bunch of them for $5 or so. Man, what a deal. The lens in this is actually not as horrendous as you'd think it would be.
We were going to talk about everybody's favorite camera of the 70s, but let's switch it to a lightning round. I don't know. Anthony, how are you doing?
I'm starting to fade.
All right, let's let Anthony get some stuff in here before he has to go. But let's name one camera that's like maybe your favorite. It doesn't have to be your ultimate favorite, but one camera from the 70s you really like, one camera that you really hate or just was a bad experience, and then maybe one camera that you think was technologically significant or just noteworthy in some way. So Anthony, why don't you start us off?
Okay. The camera that I love is going to be the Nikonos 3, which I believe is 1978. And the cue the James Bond theme song underneath me now. It was really a revolution. The 2 and the 3, both of them are cameras of the 70s. Absolutely transformed underwater photography.
Yeah.
And, you know, I still shoot both of those. I just picked up a 3 for $50, and they're such clever cameras, how they go together, how the shutter assembly works.
Yeah.
They absolutely, you know, in its little niche, changed the world. And I really think that they are in their simplicity, their engineering perfection.
Well, and they're great. They're great above ground too. I mean, they're awesome above ground. Okay, go ahead.
The camera that I guess I, you know, could care less about is the AE-1. You know, to this day, I've never shot one. I've never even held an AE-1 or an A1. The Canon cameras, for whatever reason, just never appealed to me. I've borrowed one from you, and that was the only Canon SLR that I've ever shot. Was it the SL 2000?
Yeah, it was the R2000.
R2000 is the only one I've ever shot. But the one that I think is just really clever and it's kind of the sleeper is the auto reflex that they can go from full frame to half frame. 1975 had, probably the best lenses ever put onto a half frame camera. Even more interesting than the pen lenses.
You mean for the cameras of the 60s, that's your most innovative camera, right? That's
auto reflex came out in 75.
66.
Really?
Yeah.
No, but are you talking about the auto dash reflex, which is
the auto reflex, the one that goes between half frame and full frame?
Yeah, that's the auto dash.
Yeah, that's the one with the dash. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
66, but it's a great camera.
Man, I thought that was 76 or 75. No.
But you got it in the 70s. We'll count.
Yeah,
that.
Yeah, you could buy it in the 70s. Well, and then let's be honest. Even though they did lose the half frame capability, I mean, the Konica auto non dash reflex, they were great cameras too. I mean, they made some really nice ones. So you're not too far off. I didn't want Ken Rockwell to write his hate mail and it's wrong. All right, who's next? Will, let's hear what Will has to say.
Let's see. I don't know my dates really well. My first camera ever was a Yashica Electro GSN, I think.
I was just about to mention that
70s,
camera.
70? Think, all right, you got it, right? 70?
I think that's actually 1970.
Okay. Yeah. So, and that one was promptly stolen on my first day of school. So I never used it and never had it again. And my second camera was a Canon AE-1 program, which I've had my whole life. And I love that camera. Everything about it, I think, is fantastic. Amongst all the other things I have, but yeah, 70s.
Very cool. Daniel, what do you got for us?
We're going to pretend like it's the right model, but the 2.8F, and on my screen right now, I'm showing the 2.8E. It's going to be pretty similar. They're fantastic cameras. The just rollies are so fun to shoot with. The viewfinder is great. You'll have coupled metering, even though you can probably just use another meter, which is why this is great. It has a mirror in the, this is kind of, I don't need a prism finder for it. There's the lens are covered. It has a mirror in there that we'll look down on the focusing screen. Everything about it's so fun to use, and the images are obviously great. That would be my most favorite. I am not going to talk shit on any cameras because I can't remember too many on the list. Yeah, and mine was just my favorite. It's a great camera.
Very cool. Tim, what do you got for us?
Well, my two favorite cameras from the 70s, it's a two-way tie. The Nikon FE and the Minolta XE5. I think these two, they're kind of counterparts from Minolta and Nikon. I think they're both pretty. The XE5 is really nice with its kind of black prism on the solar body. I think that looks great. But as far as just aperture priority auto exposure in the 70s, both of these have excellent meters. Great lens selection, and they just feel great in the hand. As for a camera that I don't like, I'm with Anthony. I don't really like the Canon AE-1 series. I have an AE-1P here. Just not something about it. It feels kind of plasticky, especially compared to the Nikons of the era. I never cared for the lenses that much. But the camera that I think people sleep on the most, and people are going to laugh at me for this, the Nikon EM.
Yeah, the EM is pretty good.
The EM is awesome. All my friends make fun of me for using it because it's just a dinky camera with only, only aperture priority auto exposure. But the meter in this thing is amazing. Never had a failed exposure from this. It's absolutely minuscule. And most importantly, it has full F-mount capability. So I think the EM people sleep on. Definitely get one.
The EM works at 1/90th without a battery. So, even though it was Nikon's quote unquote camera for women, which is to this very day what their website still refers to it as, it was like their other cameras in that it would work without a battery. And a feature that's very underappreciated on that camera that I really like is in the front, it's got a little backlight button, and it gives you, instead of a plus minus EV compensation that you would use in backlight situations. But the best part about it is it's momentary. So, how many times, I'm sure we've all done this, where you accidentally set a plus or minus EV through the dial and you forget to turn it off. Yeah. Whereas with this, it only is working when you're holding it down. So if you're composing your image and someone steps in front of a window, you just press and hold it, fire your picture, and then let go, and it goes back to zero. And I think
honestly, the meter in the EM is so accurate in my experience that I've never once had to actually use that button.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah, never once. Because that's not where Nikon saved money on the EM. They saved money on stripping literally every other feature out of the camera. But the meter is the same meter as they use in the professional cameras. So the meter on this is excellent. It's on par with that of the FE.
That's actually two cameras I was thinking of getting next for my next 35mm SLR. Either the EM or the FE.
Good call on that one. Did you have one that you hate or just strongly dislike?
Yeah, I said the Canon AE-1.
Oh, that's right. Series. You did say that. Yeah. Okay. I'm sorry.
I've got a couple that I want to sort of introduce. The Rolly 35, mine's from the 70s. So that, I mean, that's very iconic, very high quality, very beautiful little camera. It is scale focus, but to be honest, as a travel camera, I've never had a problem with this. It is beautiful results. If we're talking 70s, and this fits right into the mode of the 70s, is you start talking about the Trip 35. Now, hopefully I've got my years right here.
No, sorry. You're hanging out with them. It was sold in the 70s, so it's still counts.
Okay. Well, this one was sold in the 70s. I looked up the serial number. That's probably why I got confused. So, to me, that feels like the 70s, the Trip 35.
What I like about both those selections is they're both high-quality cameras that are no nonsense. You don't have any focus aids, and they just work. And if you're new to those types of cameras and you've never shot one before and it seems intimidating to not have a rangefinder or not be an SLR, don't be. Just trust the process. Learn about depth of field, learn in Sunny 16, and I guarantee you, your first roll, more than half your images, if not all of them, are going to come out great. Yep, they're wonderful cameras for that reason.
Now, I don't have one I particularly hate, but one that I don't know about yet, because I haven't tried it yet, but it's a little bit ring-in, is I have a PFAL DF1 Chinese camera, which was made in the 70s. Now they used a SRT, Minolta SRT type mount. And so you can put it on those. Okay. Yours.
I got a PFAL too.
Yeah. So they're a bit of a different thing. If you're looking for something a bit different, and you can put Minolta glass on if you really want to. So that's, you know, it's worth giving it a try. This one needs a bit of work done on it, but it's, I thought I'd bring something a bit different in here.
Does yours have the 58mm F2 lens on it? I think that's
mine has the 58 F2. Yes, the DF1 lens.
So that's a Chinese copy of the Helios 44.
Yes.
Which itself is a copy of the Biotar, I think.
Yeah.
So it's a copy of a copy, but it's not bad.
Yep. And I just love on the back here, it's got, look, not sure if you can see it, is, you know, made in China in both China. English and in Chinese.
All right.
So.
Theo, did I send you one of the lenses that I got from Kurt was a 50mm F2 lens. And if you looked at it, it looked exactly like a Pentax K-mount lens. I mean, it looked like it came right out of the Pentax factory, but it had a Minolta mount on it.
I think that was one. We'd have to go back and check, because you also sent me the Seagull and the Huaxi.
Yeah, it would have been on a Seagull. But this lens, when I looked at it, I was absolutely positive. It looked exactly like a lens that came off of a K1000, but it had an Minolta mount.
There you go. I'll have to have a look at that, because if you know, that would be an interesting one to sort of pick up.
Gearwin, do you have your famous favorite three or worst?
Yeah, well, so I'm not really sure about the dates. I mean, I guess I got them right, but... just show them. One of my favorites is the Nikon F2.
Dang it.
Classic. mostly, like, I even doubt I have, like, really shot, like, a lot of rolls with them, but I love repairing them. So that's why they're my favorite pick. And then an honorable mention as favorite one is the Olympus OM1. This is the M1 version, mainly because I really love, like, the story behind this, like, all the history stuff. One I dislike, not really hate, I love all cameras, but would be the Canon A1. As mentioned before, I mean, it's a great camera, to be honest. Like, it's a great base, but the controls are just not intuitive at all for a camera. So I really don't like using it. And then one probably honorable mention is the Alpha 11. I just Googled it because I wasn't sure. The 11EL was released in the 70s. The SI came a bit later, but it's still basically the same base. It just has the updated meter. Obviously, honorable mention because it's like a weird-ass 35mm camera while still not being too weird, I guess.
But at least those that series of Alpa, at least they went with, they got rid of the 45-degree viewfinder like the earlier ones had.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
I never liked that.
No, it's a very, very strange thing to use.
It's like, it's not eye level. It's not waist level. It's like chin level. You have to hold the camera like to your mouth. And like, then you can
I really don't know what Alpa was on because they also have like the scientific models like the 11M. But there they changed the winding lever to the correct orientation. Right, like the normal ones have like the reverse orientation, yeah.
Backwards,
and then their scientific ones just use the normal thing. Like,
okay,
they must have been smoking some weird shit back then.
We haven't heard much from Jordan. Jordan, do you have any thoughts?
Like on what's my favorite camera?
Yeah,
and what I don't
favorite
like.
Well, worst.
I talked a lot about the A1. I love that camera, but currently, I think my favorite camera I own, even though it was made in 1969, it was mainly sold in the 70s. Probably the Bronica S2A.
Good call.
And that shutter just, it's just so loud.
Yeah.
But my least favorite camera I own, I don't hate using it. It's just a pain to use, is probably the Mamiya Secor 1000 DTL. How you use the meter on it, you have to pull out the advanced lever and push it in to meter. It's
that's interesting.
Yeah, it's weird. It's a really weird camera.
They made a version of that camera called the 2000.
Yeah,
that had a top 1/2000 shutter speed, but it's super rare.
Yeah, the lens on that comes with it is not bad. It's like a, I think it's,
oh,
a,
sure,
it's a 50mm f/2.
Yeah, Mamiya was a good lens maker. Any of the Mamiya Secors are going to be good optically.
The 1.4s were Tomiokas, and they were,
oh,
excellent.
Were they?
Yeah,
I didn't know that.
Tomiokas. Yeah, they're really the steel nose. You can tell because they're steel nose.
Speaking of Mamiya, we're going to lose our internet hipster cred because not one person has mentioned the RB67.
Oh yeah, the RB67.
I was just thinking that. I just looked it up to check the date on it, actually. Good call.
Not one person has mentioned the RB67. Which...
Well, here's my favorite from the 1970s.
Ah, the Mamiya Universal Press. That's,
yep,
the
Universal
camera.
Or a Super 23, either of the two. You know, we used the RB in the 70s, and it was an excellent camera, and I used it out in the field quite a bit. But as far as flexibility and everything else, I think the Mamiya press cameras are awfully hard to beat. And the fact that you could go from a 6x9, 6x7, or they even made a back called a K-back, which was 6.45, 6x6, and 6x7.
Those are hard to find, though.
Yeah, they are. They're, and they
and
get
a lot
the
of them don't have the masks for the different
formats. the masks are the problem. But they're very reliable cameras. They're excellent lenses. And they're much more versatile, really, than an RB67 is.
They're almost like large format lenses, too.
Yeah, they've got great coverage.
Yeah, they get used a lot in large format adaptions for people doing like 6x17s and things like that.
And the original press is surprisingly small for being like a 6.9 camera. I just got one out of a box a few weeks ago, and I was like, how is this like 6.9? Like, it's very small. Especially compared to the universals and stuff.
Just back on the RB67s though, it's worth sort of mentioning that they came out with the original in 70, and then in 74 the Pro S, I believe, came out. And before it was a good, I think, 15 years or so before the SD came out, which is an amazing lifespan for a camera like that, which just sort of shows the quality that Mamiya was putting into their cameras, including the press camera and the RB67, which kind of sort of indicates why they then veered towards medium format rather than the small formats.
Even
beyond that,
the Mamiya 645 too. Those are great cameras as well.
Yeah, the only reason why I think the electronic ones get a bit of a bad rap at the moment is because the parts are just gone.
Yeah,
the actual quality of the lenses and the quality of the results were just superb.
Yes, it's my turn. My favorite was going to be the F2, you know, the Nikon F2. I've spoken before. It was more of an evolution of the original Nikon F. They didn't change a ton, but everything they updated, they made it better. Anthony, when you talked about the Nikon rangefinders, one of the first things you said was the position of the shutter release. It just didn't jive with your finger. And that's the same exact location as the Nikon F. And with the F2, they moved it in a more forward location. And for anybody who's never used both cameras, you might think, gosh, how much of a difference could that really be? But having the shutter release in a more forward position makes a huge difference.
It is a huge difference.
Yeah, the F2 obviously switched to a hinge back instead of a removable back. They relocated the battery into the body so that I could power the meter through the body. You know, they eventually, with the F2A and F2AS, they switched to the automatic indexing lenses with LED metering. I mean, for the most part, the F2 takes absolutely everything that the F did well and improves it, or leaves it the same at least, you know, ups the shutter speed to 1/2000th of a second, titanium curtains, don't have to worry about pinholes. Obviously, you know, the street cred of the F2 is, you know, as good as it was, but that's the one example of the camera where all the hype is real. I cannot think of a reason not to like the F2, except maybe the weight, I guess, if you just didn't want a big heavy camera. There's that. But if I had to pick a second Nikon from the 70s that I really liked, I mentioned earlier, it was the EL2, which was the second Nikromat that had auto exposure. And for anybody who's never seen an EL2 before, it is literally a Nikon FE, but in a Nikromat body. So if you like the larger bodied cameras, but you like the convenience of the electronic shutter with the needles, you know, in the view, the analog needles, the viewfinder, no LEDs, definitely check out an EL2. They're not super common, but they're not super rare either. They usually fly under the radar. You can find them for reasonably cheap. Some people bitch and moan about the location of the battery, which is in a weird spot behind the mirror. But I actually think there's a logic to that. By keeping the mirror, by keeping the battery more centrally located in the camera, I've come across probably a dozen EL2s in my time, and I have never, not once, found one with a corroded battery compartment. I think something about keeping the battery more inside the camera, away from moisture and the elements, helps somehow eliminate corrosion. Maybe I've just been lucky. I have no idea, but it's really not a big deal.
Wouldn't that also make them more, the battery last longer in colder temperatures too? Because it's more in the middle of the camera?
It's plausible. I think the reason they put it there in the first place is they just didn't feel like redesigning the bottom of the camera to add a battery compartment when they, because the original Nikromat EL had it in the same spot too. But it's the same, what is it, the PX23?
It's a PX28.
28.
And that's a big battery. That's a barrel battery. I mean, it's the size of 4S76s.
Yeah, it's the same one that's used in the AE1.
There's nowhere else they could have put it, really.
Right. But I mean, it works fine.
Put it on the bottom.
So who can do it with gloves on?
Change the battery?
Yeah.
Well, you know, it's funny.
Gloves on, could you?
You could. And here's why. Because you have a mirror lockup on it. So you have to lock up the mirror. You obviously have to take the lens off. But what most people fail to understand is you turn the camera upside down with the lens off and the mirror up. And there's a little door that only moves in one direction. And all you do is stick your finger in there and push it to the side. And the door, if it's upside down, will just flop open and the battery literally falls out in your hand. So getting the battery out is actually pretty easy. You don't need, even though it doesn't seem minor, how many times have you needed to open up the coin bottom battery compartment and you didn't actually have a coin? Like, I mean, I've been there before. It's like, shit, I don't have any coins or my keys on me. Like, I need to get this battery out. Like, you don't need a tool or anything else other than your finger to get the battery out of the EL and the EL2. So while I'm not raving because of the battery location, that's one con that sometimes people make fun of those cameras for the weird location, but I just don't think it's that big of a deal. But it's a Nikon, it's an FE auto exposure, but in a Nikromat size body. My least favorite, or at least the camera that's just burned me thousands of times, is that god-awful Miranda DX3. I've told this story before too, but I bought 7 of them in a lot. They were all in the original box, all of them. The silver and black Miranda box. Oh my God, one of these has to work. One of them, and none of them did.
Didn't Miranda die in the 70s?
That was their last hurrah. Yeah, it was, they were already cutting corners for quite a bit before that camera. And this was a company that was already on its deathbed, already cutting corners. And then what do? They release an all new, brand new camera with electronics in it. I mean, it was a recipe for disaster, but I thought, if you try enough of them, even the most unreliable cameras out there, if you try, you'll eventually find one that works. And that's one camera that I've never, ever seen. I think someone on this show mentioned getting one recently and trying to get it to work. And no, it just didn't work. But there's that one. And then we barely mentioned it, but I'm surprised we haven't talked about the Pentax K1000. You know, we talked about how popular the AE1 was. And while the AE1 and K1000 are almost complete opposite ends of the spectrum, they're similar in that they're both extraordinarily popular. They're both, you know, that student camera. But where the AE1, you know, suffers from the noisy mirror and, you know, maybe some of the electronics, but the K1000, which is a mechanical, basic, just no holds barred, no frills camera that just works really, really well. And, you know, obviously there's billions of excellent K mount lenses that are worthwhile to put on there.
You see, Mike, I'd be going for the ES2 instead of the K1000.
In terms of Pentaxes, it's definitely not their best. I mean, if I had to pick my favorite K mount, I'd go with the LX or even the MX. But for what it is I think the K1000 is the quintessential student camera. It's predictable, it's simple, it's basic, it's reliable, it's cheap, but it delivers wonderful results. And I would take that over an AE1 any day of the week. But yeah, the ES2, that's 72, wasn't it?
I think 74.
Well, there you go. So we'll just pretend when you said auto reflex, you meant to say the ES2. Yes.
You know, it's the punk rock camera. It's the one that Penny Smith used in all of the photographing the Clash and the Sex Pistols. Yeah, and it's quirky. They're not holding up so well these days, although I've been very lucky in that I've got two ES that both work perfectly. I was just shooting it this weekend, actually. And I like the way that camera handles.
Well, you've mentioned it many times. I mean, I know for a fact that that's one of your favorite cameras.
It really is.
Did we miss anybody? Patrick, did you tell us your favorite camera?
Oh, I made my pitch for the Instamatic 60.
That's right.
I'm another F2 fan. I upgraded from a Nikkormat to it. I had a Nikkormat ELW. You want to talk about oddball Nikkormats before the EL2. I think the ELW came out with a winder.
Yeah.
But when I got to an F2, I thought, okay, now I'm there. And it has the feel, the silky, the all that everything. And I'm another one. Canons until the EOS mount, I just never, when EOS came along, I switched from Nikon to Canon. It was that remarkable for me. But I'm one who the AE1, I sort of respected it, but I just, the ergonomics and the feel of it just didn't push my buttons.
I feel the same way. There's nothing wrong with it. Oh, and an honorable mention for me, and only because I've only recently picked it up, but I do really like, Paul, the Leica Flex SL2. It's really nice.
It's a very cool camera.
Unfortunately, the lenses are borderline unobtainium in terms of pricing these days, but otherwise it's just smooth, you know?
Did you shoot anything with the R4 yet?
No, it hasn't even come out of the box yet.
Yeah, you haven't played with it. Well, test it out because I checked it and it was working fine.
Okay.
But, you know, R4s are... Anthony, how reliable are R4s?
I think it's me, you mean. I went through a couple of them.
Yeah, I'm sorry. That's who I meant.
Yeah. No, I went through a couple of them and then just put an R8. So, they can be hit and miss. Interesting enough, I mean, one of them was an item that really probably could have been overlooked. It was the counter only, but I just couldn't sort of risk it. But they are fantastic to actually shoot with, though. So I really enjoyed them, but it was just, just didn't work out. I'll probably go back and buy one, though.
I'm looking at an R6 right now. Some guy on Facebook Marketplace has one for $500, which is actually a good deal.
6 or 6.2?
It's a 6. The only difference between the two is a 2,000th of a second shutter speed, which is never a 2,000th of a second shutter speed. Anyway.
For anybody who's interested in the Leica R series cameras, a book recommendation is this one. It's called Leica... The Book of the Leica R Series Cameras by Brian Long. And what's really cool about this book is all the pages are full color. There's a ton of photos. They show a lot of like marketing, how the camera was marketed, all the different lenses. There's a lot of history, which appeals to me. So it talks a lot about just how the camera was developed, all the different variations of it and such like that. So some books kind of borderline more on the just what kind of accessories there were. Some of them, you know, go really deep into the weeds on the history. And this is like the ultimate coffee table book for Leica R-series cameras. So If that's something that's interested to you, I would definitely recommend this one.
You mentioned the SL2 and how the lenses aren't obtainable. And the only obtainable lenses I can think of that work on that camera are the Tamron Adaptol lenses.
Yeah, they did make the Adaptol mount for it, which will allow you to adapt and just shoot some stuff on it too. And I'm sure there's adapters. I'm sure somebody makes an adapter for it.
Is the unobtainium because they manufactured a few of them? And of course, being Leica, they're highly desirable. Is that?
Yeah, they're expensive.
Well, it's those two. And then add to that is they've become incredibly popular with cine photographers. Who like to de-click them. So that's part of the reason why if you go on eBay and look for any Leica Flexes, they're almost always just the bodies with hardly any lenses because people are snapping up all the lenses and using them, right? Isn't that what you found, Paul? The same crowd is using them?
Yeah, and you know, the other confusion part is that they actually made four different types of R lenses. They had the single cam, the two cam, the three cam, and then the R only. People were intimidated by not knowing exactly which lens they needed for their camera, and it was hard to identify them. I mean, it isn't easy to look at the back of a lens and see the difference between a two cam and a three cam.
Right.
You really got to know what you're looking for.
People don't like all of Nikon's lens mount variants, but at least if you know what you're looking for, you can tell just by looking at them which version you have.
Nikons are pretty much a slam dunk anymore.
And then you can't rely on the actual serial number too, because my 50 millimeter lens is actually a modified two cam that's been modified to three cam.
Yeah. Leica would modify them for like $25.
Yeah.
So you'll see a lens and you look at it and you think it must be a two cam, but then when you look at it closely, you see it's actually a three.
But to annoy people, I sometimes put this on my R8 even. It's a Soligar wide 35 millimeter 3.5. which has got the adapter and it sits on
there. You go.
And I posted some pictures and I think I got probably the greatest amount of hate mail. Oh, no, that one.
It's like a Miranda lens on a Leica.
I have some Vivitar T4 mounts for Leica Flex.
Oh, I might have to borrow those.
I think it probably is the same lens you have, same mount.
Oh, okay, cool. But yeah, it's Soligar. Yeah, stick a Soligar onto an R camera and you're guaranteed hate mail.
Well, we've hit that time. This one went fast, guys. I want to thank all of you guys for coming. We did lose a couple people, but Will, thanks for coming on. Tim, you're always welcome here. Patrick, Casey, Jordan, two episodes in a row. Gearwin left already, but it's great to have you guys on. We always want as many people as possible to come. As we mentioned in the intro to the show, we got some vacations coming up, so that is going to affect the cadence of the next few episodes. So we don't exactly know when our next episode is going to be, but obviously I will post when we know on the Discord, on our Facebook page, on my website too. So be on the lookout for our next topic. We know we haven't done much justice to Zeiss Icon cameras, so we definitely are going to start covering that, but there's no way we'll be able to do it all in a single episode. So we'll probably split it up into maybe eras or something like that. But we definitely want feedback from you guys. You know, do you like the camera by decade concept? Should we do a different decade? Should we do the 80s? Should we do the 40s? You know, I don't know. Are there any brands that we really haven't covered in a great detail or styles of photography that you guys want to hear us talk about? So please continue to talk to us through the Discord or any of our other social medias, through Instagram or such like that, because we do get some awesome discussion from all the different people who like listen to the show. So I want to thank you guys again for coming on the show and stay tuned for our next show announcement. But good night, everybody.
Good night.
Thank you. Good night.
Good night. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
From Television City in Hollywood.
Boy, the way Glenn Miller played.
Songs that made the hit parade.
Guys like us, we had it made.
Those were the days. And you knew when you were there.
Dance for girls and men, women.
Mister, we could use a man like Herbert Hoover again.
welfare state.
Everybody pulled his weight.
GRO.